Hi, folks. Welcome to March. We are so lucky to be here with Marcy again. Marcy, let's dive in. All right. So first news item on the economic front, inflation. Inflation numbers were up more than we were expecting. I'm seeing words like surge and acceleration in the headlines. Where are we today with this? And you know, before I release you, I'm doing a lot of preambles here, but guys, in December, Marcy reminded us, here we are towards the end of Q3, Marcy said, please take all headlines with a grain of salt during Q1, because it's going to get herky jerky. So Marcy, walk us through the herky jerky to start with.
Here it is. We are in Q1, first quarter of 2024, and financial markets are expecting the Federal Reserve to actually cut rates in June, right? But the road, the path to getting there, which, you know, June's only 3-4 months away, right? But the road, the path to getting there is feels a little bit one step forward, two steps back, two steps forward, one step back. And that happened again with this month's inflation numbers. And so, as you said, they came in a little higher than expected. But I do want to put that into perspective, because surge, it definitely was not. Markets were expecting inflation to stay steady at 3.1%, and it came in at 3.2%. So the difference between 3.1% and 3.2%, I just can't get in the surge camp. That doesn't feel like a surge to me. And remember that a large portion of the increase was in two sectors: energy, which is extremely volatile, moves all over the place, and owner's equivalent rent. So if you look at the CPI numbers, one of the things that's a little peculiar about them is they want to somehow take into account the cost of housing, right? But they can't do it through mortgage payments. They can't actually even do it in changes in rental prices. The way that they do it instead is they look at something called owner's equivalent rent. And what they say is, let's suppose that Americans, instead of owning their homes, rented their houses, right? Now they don't, right? So this isn't actual inflation, but it's just some proxy, some way to try to figure out how do we incorporate housing. And this is the best that they have come up with. Now, owner's equivalent rent basically says Marcy lives in a 2,500 square foot house in Chicago, right? Which I don't, I'm just making these numbers up. And what would it cost her to rent that house? Well, you guys all understand how many 25 square foot rental houses are there, you know, in Chicago? Probably not that many. And you also know that the number of those is getting small and small and small. So you're running into this small sample size problem in that it's hard to find an analogy, right? So they're doing the best they can, but it's giving us some wonky numbers around overall CPI inflation. So it's trending in the right direction, right? So 2 years ago, CPI was 8.5%, and today it's 3.2%. But don't make too much about sort of month over month numbers when it comes to trying to get an accurate measure. Does it matter to me or you if it's 3.1 or 3.2? It just needs to keep moving in the right direction. And so the Federal Reserve is going to need to see a 2% number. That's their target. We're 100 basis points away. And the question is, will it come by the June meeting? And inflation numbers right now are extremely hard to predict. They're always hard to predict, but there was a note from the Federal Reserve Board of Governors talking about just how much the uncertainty around economic forecasting has gone up post-COVID. And so it's a really new piece of work that I've been sort of looking at. Maybe I'll share some of those statistics with you guys next time, because there's some interesting charts and graphs kind of showing how it's really hard right now to sort of look forward and say, where is inflation headed?
So in that same bucket and sort of edging towards the next Fed meetings, let's talk growth and jobs as well here, because 3 months ago at the beginning of the year, I was hearing predictions that we'd be seeing growth in Q1 around 1%. Now we're seeing more 2-ish, I believe. That's doubled. I mean, that's, again, the herky-jerky, right? On the jobs front, we're seeing 275,000 jobs added just last month. I mean, again, none of this. And U.S. unemployment, I mean, we're down below 4%, but it's up to 3.9, right? So highest in 2 years. like uptick in inflation? Definitely not this month, right? We've got a Fed's meeting coming up. June, maybe, but give us sort of the macro picture here in terms of what we're going to be seeing for the next couple of months.
Well, certainly growth in the first quarter of this year is coming in higher than everyone expected. Now, it's one of those weird periods of times where when growth comes in higher than expected, that's bad news, right? Because the Fed might not cut rates, right? So we're in those weird periods of time where if there's strong job growth, that's bad news. Now, I don't personally think that's bad news, because when I look at job growth, job creation, what I understand is that for the overall economy out there, people's incomes, people having stable jobs, income that they can count on, all matter when it comes to making big ticket purchases, to their confidence around, should I buy a house now? Should I take on a mortgage? If unemployment was higher, people wouldn't want to be doing that. So fundamental to sort of strong demand are things like the job market, things like economic growth. Now, you and I have talked about in times past that the Federal Reserve now has a new indicator called GDP Now, and it is calculated by the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, and they update their GDP forecast basically based on the data that's coming in every single day. And this thing is proven to be very reliable. So instead of having to wait a month after the first quarter is over to get a preliminary estimate of GDP, we now have a pretty decent one in real time. So this is part of this enormous data revolution that's happened in economics overall that personally makes my job easier, more fun, because now I don't have to wait for this old dated data. I can tell you in real time, kind of get a much better sense of what's happening with the economy in real time. So we know it's growing about 2.5%, really strong GDP number for the first quarter. So if the economy is growing at 2.5%, I guess, how's that? 2.5%, right? That's a little finger, right? And inflation is at 2%. You add those two numbers together to get the proper Fed funds target rate. So if inflation comes down to 2%, economy's growing at 2.5%, then suddenly a 4.5% Fed funds target rate is what makes sense. But if inflation's at 3%, then 5.5% is what makes sense. So this is why, you know, we're watching those inflation numbers very, very carefully. If growth suddenly goes to zero, then you want to cut your Fed funds target rate a lot faster. But that's not where we are right now. Never forget, friends, economies pretty much, if you leave them to their own devices, they want to grow. They have an underlying GDP trend rate. And in the US, it's somewhere between 2 and 2.5. So we're kind of right there in the sweet spot. The unemployment rate has been below what everyone would consider normal for quite some time. So an unemployment rate of about 4% is probably more of an equilibrium unemployment rate than the 3.5, 3.4 that we were seeing last year when labor markets were so incredibly tight. But what we know is that people are coming back into the job market. A lot of people who left during COVID, maybe early retired or stayed home to take care of their kids, and now they're just coming back into the job market. And so you're going to see that uptick in unemployment numbers because people are coming back into the job market. So again, like, it's hard to go, is that a bad thing or a good thing? You know, I try to help you guys make sense of, is it good or is it bad? And usually it's a little bit of both.
Yeah. I sometimes throw at you an Econ 101 question, and I've got one for you now. What we're also focused on, yay, you know, 2024, we're going to see the Fed's cut rates. From an economic standpoint and an impact standpoint, what does that actually mean for us as consumers, for us in the housing? Like, why are we so excited about that, Marcy?
Well, I think it's because we all kind of got accustomed to pretty cheap money, right? I mean, when a Fed funds target rate was zero, it meant you had mortgage rates at 3, 3.5, maybe 4%. It means businesses could borrow at 5, 5.5%. It meant all this sort of cheap money flowing out there. Now, you want, though, for the long run, for money to be priced appropriately. If it's too cheap, relative to what it should be, then you get these shortages. And that's what happened in housing. Everybody rushed in to try to buy and take advantage of low mortgage rates because they weren't equilibrium. They weren't where they ought to have been, and everyone knew it was short term. So you get these big fluctuations in spending that are disruptive to markets. So particularly when you talk about housing, you know, if you take a bird's eye view, you know, overall view of the economy, you can say, oh, soft landing for the economy, no disruptions from higher rates. Oh, really? Talk to your average real estate agent. They understand that high interest rates have been very disruptive because you get this lock-in effect. People don't want to let go of their old mortgages to go to new mortgages. So stability in prices is extremely important. Right, for stability in markets. It's why inflation, we target it at a certain rate, because prices going up and down and up and down and up and down introduce all this uncertainty that's bad for people, consumers, and businesses. Interest rates are the price of money. And if they've got all this volatility in interest rates, that's bad for markets as well. And you guys, each and every one of you, are on the front lines of all of this.
I actually just got another sort of Econ 101 question from the audience as well. I love this, bringing it to basics. It's a good question. What is the June meeting? Like, talk about the Fed's meetings, and especially since this, like, we got one next week, we got one in June, and then there are another five more opportunities for stuff to happen with those meetings. So break down what that June meeting actually means.
Really quickly. So basically, happens is that the Board of Governors, right, of the Federal Reserve is based in Washington, D.C. And that Board of Governors is not just responsible for monetary policy, it's also responsible for regulating banks. It's responsible for the supply of currency. It's responsible, obviously, for monetary policy, but it does a whole bunch of things. It has a huge research department. Then there are these regional banks all over the United States. There's 12 regional banks, and this system was set up in 1914. So there's a regional bank in New York, Boston, Richmond, Atlanta, San Francisco, Minneapolis, in all these places that were centers of economic activity in 1914. Now the economy's changed, but they haven't moved the banks around. So you've got two banks in, you know, in like one in Kansas City and one in St. Louis, like really close together. You wouldn't set it up that way now, right? But they did this. And each one has a bank president. And I think it's six of those bank presidents sit on the FOMC committee at any given time that meets to determine the Fed funds target rate. And they meet every 6 weeks, right? So when I was a young economist at the Federal Reserve Bank in Dallas, part of my job was to supply data on the economy to the bank president for him to go to this meeting in Washington and sit on this committee and make these interest rate decisions. So it's done by committee. The chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, any chairman typically has the strongest voice, but these regional bank presidents, they contribute to monetary policy. They have their own ideas about where it ought to be. And it is a vigorous, fascinating debate that we can actually see into because they publish minutes of the meeting and Jerome Powell has a press conference afterwards. So it's way more information now than there was back in 1996 when I was a young economist and it was just kind of a black box. You didn't know what they talked about really. Now we have a much better idea of what their thinking is. And this introduces more stability into monetary policy because more information when it comes to these things leads to a better expectation among the public and more credibility because we know what they're doing and why they're doing it.
Fantastic. So guys, we are going to go next two topics, residential and then commercial. Let's start with residential, and I'm going to tie in, we're already getting some audience questions. Guys, if there's anybody on here who has never done an Economic Insights, first of all, welcome to the best and most elite club in the world for economic updates for our industry with Marcy. Second of all, guess what? You get to do Q&A with Marcy. So we're already getting a few. Please go ahead and stick those in the box. We'll get to as many as we can. Laura asks, and let's tie this in, and I'll ask my sort of general question, but can you tie in what the bond rate is going to do for future mortgage rates? And so generally speaking, just sort of pitching the question at you, we've got mortgage rates down on 30-year fixed right now at 6.84 last week, I believe, under 7%, which is sort of a marker that we've been watching first time in a while. And we are seeing a pretty quick response from the market, right? We've got mortgage applications last week up around 5%, still 11% lower year over year, but looking better. I mean, I know you warned us to take a no hope, no fear kind of attitude, but this is sounding hopeful, Marcy. So lay it out and then wrap in Laura's bond question as well, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure. So the way that all these things are related is that the Federal Reserve moves these ultra short-term rates, right? They're overnight rates, basically, in an effort to get inflation low, because inflation matters for long-term rates. So I want to be really clear. If the Federal Reserve had kept interest rates at zero and inflation had stayed at 8%, that would have meant that 10-year rates, if people were expecting 8% inflation, like they do in places like Egypt, Argentina, where they expect 50 and 60% inflation, this drives interest rates way up over time. So if you're thinking that, oh, if the Fed had just kept rates at 1% or 2%, mortgage rates would have stayed low, that is not true at all. The relationship between short-term rates and long-term rates is much more complicated. And for long-term rates to stay relatively low over time, we all have to believe that the Fed is going to keep inflation under control. Otherwise, we're Brazil, for instance, right, where no one, you know, that there's this bigger cushion, right, in longer term rates, right? So I want to be real clear about that. But in general, mortgage rates tend to kind of track the direction of 10-year treasuries loosely, right? So they're not connected to short-term rates, they're connected to 10-year rates. And so 10-year rates, as the Federal Reserve has raised short-term rates, those have gone up as well. And so you get long-term rates, particularly mortgage rates, going up. But I think that there's something else in mortgage rates too. There's prepayment risk. And so when mortgage rates get in this 6 to 7% range, there's this risk that when rates come back down, all those mortgages are going to be refied. So investors want to be compensated for that risk. So you get, when interest rates get, mortgage rates get above 6%, you get this prepayment risk laying on top of it so that you don't get this gradual increase. You get these really sharp increases. And I think we're in that territory as well. So just to sort of say how all of these things are arranged. But I do think that what's more important for mortgage rates to come down is for inflation to come down, not for the Fed to move. We need inflation to be back to that 2% target. Everybody needs to see it. They need to believe it. Then they'll be confident that the Fed brings short-term rates down to probably 4.5%, which probably means that treasuries come down to maybe 5, which gets us back in mortgage rate territory, 5.5-6%, I personally think.
Fantastic. And let's talk inventory for a second too, because of course we've got stagnation on new construction for residential as well. In terms of all of this macro movement throughout the course of the year, is there any hope that we're gonna see additional layers of new inventory coming online in the next 12 to 24 months?
You need builders to build. You need communities to continue to make zoning more attractive for builders. And you're really seeing that. It's just, it's so slow, Jess. Gosh, it's so slow. I've seen estimates that basically we're 4 million homes short of where we need to be in America. And you guys hear me? I beat this just to death, right? You've just got to build more houses, and we all have to do everything we can to put pressure on communities to allow for accessory dwellings, to let people build on smaller lots, to do all the things that will take years, unfortunately, to reverse this problem. But I'm a big believer. I don't care what your problem is. Start today. Put down the shovel, friends, whatever your shovel is. And if it's real estate, pick up the shovel.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. We need shovels in the dirt, right?
Shovels in the dirt. So put one shovel down. Pick up a new one.
Awesome. Okay, let's talk commercial. We got a lot of commercial folks on, including some global folks. So lots of discomfort continuing in this sector. Obviously, we're seeing a pileup of distressed loans. I read a news piece recently that described the situation as a slow-moving train wreck. Do you agree with that analysis? And what should we be looking for in the next couple of quarters?
I think the problem actually is smaller than people think it is. This is a $4 trillion problem. It's a $27 trillion economy. Office space is what's in trouble. Commercial real estate, I'm looking at an IKEA right out there. IKEA is not in trouble. Now, some real estate is in trouble, but basically hotels are doing great. warehousing is doing great. Medical facilities are doing great. Senior housing is improving. These are all commercial real estate as an asset class is really heterogeneous. There are all kinds of different commercial real estate in America. Office space accounts for $4 trillion of it. Now, just to get a sense of the relative magnitude of problems, from 2007 to 2009, residential real estate in America lost a third of its value. Most of us were there for that. We know how painful it was, not just for our sector, but it had all these spillover effects to the rest of the economy, which is what most folks worry about. So when everybody says office space in trouble, they basically go, is this going to be a repeat of the housing crisis with all of its sort of spillover effects and difficulties for consumers? If we had that kind of decline in America today, it would be a $16 trillion problem. That's the magnitude of the loss. So if residential real estate went through the same thing it went through in the financial crisis, the loss to the US economy alone would be $16 trillion, right? Office space is only worth $4 trillion. So if it loses 100% of its value, every office in America is completely worthless. That's a problem that's 25% of the size of the financial crisis. Now, that's a lot of numbers. So we're going to have to, you know, we'll send that out in our talking points, but you need some perspective on the size of this problem because you're going to get distracted by the headlines that say office building in San Francisco sold for a dollar. Office building in New York sells for 50% of its original value. Those handful of headlines are going to grab everyone's attention because that's what they're designed to do. And some people are going to take some real losses. It's going to hurt if you are holding that debt, if you're in that office space. But if you're in warehousing, it doesn't matter. If you're in senior housing, it doesn't matter. Now, multifamily, everybody's saying multifamily is overbuilt. I'm not getting in that camp. Multifamily and rents have been high relative to incomes for a long time. So you're going to have to see big declines in rent before you get me in the camp of overbuilding. We are so short of shelter in this country. We need to talk about it the right way. Call it shelter. Call it a roof over people's heads. We need more apartments. We need more everything.
Okay. Great. Guys, keep the questions coming. They're flowing in here. I want more. Let's talk China before we turn it over to a few questions. And then, guys, again, I'm going to do a quick antitrust update given today's news with more to come early next week, given the headlines. So, Marcy, China, speaking of sort of the slow moving train wreck type headlines, nobody's been bullish about China for the last couple of years, sort of post COVID slump. Now, though, all of a sudden, some pundits are saying, okay, there's light at the end of the tunnel for China. So two-part question. One is the Econ 101 question, which is, what is that impact on a global scale? Why do we focus on China so much during our conversations? And then what do you feel we will be seeing from China in the next couple of quarters?
Well, I think there's something really peculiar about the way that Americans talk about almost everything. It's always a competition with us, right? Yeah. We love sports. Sports is an important part of everyone's life. It's competition, even though most of us don't play football, but we love to watch it, right? Yeah. You've heard me say before, our politics has become competitive, like a sporting event. Your loss is my gain is your loss, right? So everything is like that. And then when we turn around to economies, we do the exact same thing. We always have to have some sort of competitor. So when I was a young economist, it was China, or excuse me, it was Japan, right? Japan was gonna, you know, eat our lunch. They were, you know, buying up commercial real estate in America. We were all gonna need to speak Japanese because their economy was gonna be bigger than ours, right? They suffer from the same problems China has right now. Lots of debt, deflation, and most importantly, demographic decline. So the Japanese population starts to go into reverse and suddenly their economy just kind of flatlines. Now, Japan's economy is still in the top five. They're a very important economy. We just don't talk about them as a major competitor. China went through the same exact process. They were our main economic competitor. We put tariffs on them. We did all these sorts of things. They're also, though, political competitor as well, which makes them a little bit different than Japan, which was an ally. But nevertheless, China is facing a 214 million person decline in their working age population. 214 million people, all the people that poured in the labor markets and gave them that cheap labor competitive advantage, that goes into reverse over the next 27 years. So we're going to talk about China very, very differently. It's not that they won't be important, just like Japan is important. We're just not going to talk about them the same. Who are we going to talk about? We're going to talk about India, because at exactly the same time frame as China's working age population is declining, India's is increasing by 147 million people. So you mark my words, 10 years from now, we're going to be talking about the economic competition coming from India, of all places, much like we've talked about China over the last 10 years. It's not that they're not important, it's just that the dialogue changes.
Awesome. Marcy, I didn't realize that we're in post-game. It's 3:31. So let's do a couple real quick sort of micro touches and then promise to build that out in our next Economic Insights in April. So question number one, we've got a couple questions actually of folks asking about this being an election year and what you see in terms of economic impact.
Sure. As I said at conference, I don't give presidents too much credit when things go right, and I don't blame them when things go wrong. So over and over and over again, I see this happen in every election cycle, depending on what your political preference is. If X wins, it's going to be a disaster. If Y wins, it's going to, everything's going to be perfect. And it's never that way. But I do think maybe we need to sort of generate some numbers and maybe talk about this a little bit more at our next one. But I don't think the political cycle matters for the real economy as much as people think it does.
Okay, great. We can build that out more as required in the next one. And then we've got folks asking about the impact of now we've got two significant wars fomenting and continuing to cause just horror. Can you talk about economic impacts there across the board?
Strangely, the economic impacts have been very, very small. The global economy has managed to be quite resilient in the face of tremendous, real, genuine pain. But it has not had the spillovers this time around. I think fundamentally, the overall economy of the globe was strong, and it hasn't really affected the two biggest economies on the planet, which are the US and China. And if the US and China were directly involved, be different. But these you know, are not huge economies that are involved either. But it doesn't, you know, as we say, it doesn't take away from the overall, you know, pain and suffering that real people are experiencing right now.
Absolutely. Okay. Marcy, that's amazing. We will see you back in April. Marcy, travel safe. Enjoy yet another jet setting experience, and we will see you soon.